welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. The title of this week's podcast is Unlocking the Mystery of Life and Icons of Evolution, Various Criticisms. This episode is going to be based on two intelligent design anti-evolution videos that I recently saw. Both of these have similar faces from the intelligent design camp, like Jonathan Wells and Michael Behe. Some actually pose scientific claims about evolution. We're going to see how these hold up under actual scientific scrutiny, and take a look at how these videos are also presented to the viewer, see how they kind of twist their case to make it more acceptable to the viewer, who doesn't know maybe anything about creationism, intelligent design, or anything like that. So there's going to be no creationist claim for this section, excuse me, for this week, because these DVDs are basically creationist claims in and of themselves. So we're going to hop right into the science topic then. We'll start with the DVD, Unlocking the Mystery of Life. I saw this DVD a little while back. I took some notes on it. At first, I found that it depicted evolution in fine light. It explained it correctly. But then they try to create this dichotomy of micro versus macro evolution, as if they weren't the same process, as if microevolution and macroevolution were two totally distinct things when one is simply the longer inevitable outcome of the first. Microevolution over a long period of time that will allow lots of change is going to lead to macroevolution. There's no real difference. It's kind of this wording that creationists and intelligent design advocates like to use, but really doesn't have any actual meaning. Then right away we see Michael Behe bringing up his irreducible complexity idea. His examples that he brings up were falsified in the Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District case last year that kind of said intelligent design is really not scientific at all. And in this movie, he uses his famous bacteria flagellum argument. I'd like to also mention that the Evolution 101 podcast did an entire segment on irreducible complexity and why it's not correct. And there was also a Talk Design article. That's a website I visit to look at some information. And I will link to that website to show you the actual evolutionary or hypothesized evolutionary progress that this bacteria flagellum could have made all the way from the beginning. Because in the movie, they mention the secretory system, which is if you take away 30 proteins in the bacteria flagellum, then you will have a different function. But they say there's no other function between then. So, but if you have 29 proteins missing, then there's no function for that. If you have 15 missing, there's no function. Well, this article in Talk Design shows that there is function for all the way up to what we know it is now. So that claim is totally out, and their scientific claim regarding bacteria flagellum just doesn't work, and the whole example is not irreducibly complex. The wording in this movie is also very interesting, you should note. Instead of just cells, they're cellular machines. And I think it's said to somehow make this notion of a designer somewhat more acceptable to the public. If people think, oh, these things actually do work like machines and they have little gadgets here, then this idea of a designer will somehow be more perceptible, more acceptable to the listener in question. But irreducible complexity fails to convince people when one actually understands pre-adaptationism, which is change in function. The functions can change, and the movie tried to address this a little bit, as I said, about the secretory system, which was the prior form of the bacteria flagellum. With 30 proteins missing, it still has a function of injecting its stuff into other cells. But the video basically just shrugs this off. Again, we see wording like, the blueprint of life is like the blueprint of a house. So again, we see this designer analogy, which is not a very good analogy. Basically, we're just seeing a formalist argument here. Last week, we discussed functionalism versus formalism. This is basically a formalism argument that we have a bunch of structures, and they're all pointing to this notion of a designer. But that's really not scientific in and of itself. Then the video talks about abiogenesis, which is the origin of life. Now, these people, I don't know if they realize this, but evolution is not actually dealing with the origin of life. It has nothing to do with it. They're two totally separate fields. Evolution assumes life and works ahead. It starts with a single-celled organism. It doesn't start with nothingness. It doesn't start with simple chemicals leading to life. That's the job of abiogenesis. But what the video does say about abiogenesis is really making a straw man of what the case for the origin of life is scientifically. First, they take this notion of chemical evolution, which might confuse people. Chemical evolution is not evolution. It's not the theory of evolution. you might notice that Kent Hovind, if you've ever heard him, he likes to say chemical evolution and talk about, I believe he uses it for the origin of stars. But he has so many different terms that are not scientific, I can't really recall. But this idea of chemical evolution, that proteins were somehow naturally going to combine with one another to create life, this idea was about 30 years old and it was refuted. And then the ID movie does not mention any other new abiogenesis ideas, like the RNA world hypothesis, for instance. It mentions none of these. Basically, if they refute chemical evolution, they want us to assume that there's no ideas out there and no one knows how life formed. So they kind of create this straw man of we have no ideas, but, well, we actually do. So then the ID movement asks, we want to know the origin of biological information in DNA. Like amino acids, they say amino acids are biological information in DNA. But again, this all goes back to abiogenesis. This is something abiogenesis has to answer. And abiogenesis is rather a new field. I mean, they just started doing experiments in the 50s, excuse me, in the 20s, I believe, they conjured up experiments what the origin of life could have been and tested it out. But this is a rather new field, and now with our knowledge of molecular structures and stuff like that, we'll be able to better test our ideas, our hypotheses about what the origin of life actually is. We'll have to recreate these scenarios in the laboratory because obviously the Earth is not the same as it was back then. And one interesting side I'd like to point out is that when we do that, the intelligent design advocates will be saying, well, you need life in order to create life. And you just demonstrated that by making life in a laboratory, which really makes the idea of an intelligent designer unfalsifiable. If life can't happen with the right stuff we have now, and we have to recreate the scenario in a lab, well, that just means we're letting things run in this laboratory. It's not as if life couldn't have formed 4.6 billion years ago, or 4 billion years ago, and that you needed life to create it. No, we don't have the right atmosphere right now. We don't have the right environment to lead to another natural abiogenesis event. And just because human beings have to recreate this in the laboratory does not imply that intelligent designers are needed to create life. It's not too much long after this talk about abiogenesis that we run into Stephen Meyer again. If you remember, Stephen Meyer was the man who had the debate with Peter Ward that I critiqued. And he uses some more of his bad analogies regarding humans and recognizing patterns. You see, he says if we recognize patterns in our work, say we see a piece of writing on the ground, we know humans did it. Well, if we see, say, machines at work in the human body, or something that's analogous to a machine, we can say a designer did this. Again, this is incorrect. We know humans make machines. We don't know anything else that does make a machine. So to make this extrapolation that humans make machines, we see machines in cells, therefore it's some kind of other designer, well, that doesn't really fly. Logically, it would just be we see a machine in a cell, therefore humans made machines, so humans made the cell. Well, we know that isn't correct, therefore we can't make any of these odd assumptions that some other kind of designer did it. There's no evidence of another designer. So just to make this analogy is trying to make intelligent design sound acceptable to the public when it's not really science, and these bad analogies do nothing to help the case. Shortly after this, we're introduced to William Dembski. William Dembski is a mathematician who thought he had a way to detect design in nature. He calls this his filter, so we're going to be discussing Dembski's filter. Basically, it goes like this. If there's a pattern and it's improbable, that means it was designed. Now, of course, this seems like nothing but anthropomorphization. That's basically attributing human attributes to things that aren't human. So if I see a cloud that might be shaped like a face, I would say, hey, there's a face up there, when there's really no such thing as my mind making patterns. So what exactly is a pattern? I mean, Dembski specifically says in the film that it must be an objective pattern, but what exactly is an objective pattern? So that's one question I have to ask Dembski that doesn't make any sense. And then these two notions of pattern and improbability leading to design, I can find examples in nature that would show this, but then demonstrate this is obviously false. A pattern and improbability alone do not lead to the knowledge of design. For instance, there is an old man of the mountain. Now, this geological feature collapsed recently, but beforehand it had a recognizable face profile, so it was a side profile of a face, and it was basically a geologic pattern in the rock. And it was recognizable, it was a recognizable pattern, and it was very improbable to see this actually just sitting on the side of the face of a rock, yet it was natural. There was no creation event. No one designed this, obviously. So Dembski's filter really does not work. Not to mention, William Dembski could simply say, well, the old man on the mountain was designed. It was designed, and there'd be no way to falsify that. He just makes a claim and says, this is what is needed for design. But how do we falsify that? How do we say this isn't what we needed for design? If he can take a natural example like this old man of the mountain and say it was designed, there's no way to tell him he was wrong. Besides just saying it, he was wrong, and he would say, no, this is exactly what we need for design. Here it is. Finally, if we take a look at what the Intelligent Design video actually says, it tries to come across as this movement that's seeking the objective truth and trying to make intelligent design sound like a valid scientific theory, when it really, really is not. The science overall in this film, though, was fairly decent. Again, though, just like the Privileged Planet video, their conclusions were really, really poor. Again, this is a common theme with the Intelligent Design films. You'll have good science with bad conclusions. So they take the good science and try to convince you that they actually know what they're talking about, which sometimes they actually do, and then they'll lead on some stray path that leads someone away from what science actually can talk about and leads them into the realm of the supernatural or other unfalsifiable ideas, like an intelligent designer. Moving on to the next video, Icons of Evolution. This movie, I have to say, is the one I like the least out of all the intelligent design films. My friend recommended it to me. He let me borrow it because we were arguing before about the Cambrian explosion, and he was using some arguments that he had picked up off of this film, so I decided I had to see it for myself. This DVD is basically, it's based off of a book by Jonathan Wells called Icons of Evolution, where he takes certain well-known examples of evolution and tries to debunk them, or show that they're not actually demonstrating what they're trying to demonstrate. So, this video was produced in 2002, and I just had to take a look at it and see what kind of arguments they had, and see if they were actually undermining the arguments about evolution presented by evolutionary scientists. I noticed this video had a bit of an underdog complex coming along with it. It came off across like, we're the poor, oppressed, intelligent design movement, just trying to show the world some real science, while this evil evolutionist conspiracy is trying to keep us quiet. And I don't mean to mock it, but that is basically what it came across as. They're oppressed, and they're trying to show us the truth, but evolution is trying to keep them down and not let them speak out. It starts with the story of a Burlington teacher. Burlington's fairly close to where I live, so this is sort of interesting. And he was trying to be critical, quote-unquote, of evolution. Again, you can see how they word things to try to make the public sympathetic to what they're saying. But giving kids fringe science and saying it's on par with a theory like evolution that's been backed by mountains of evidence is the least bit misleading. If I say the Earth is flat and I tell people criticisms about it, that are invalid, of course, about the round Earth idea, and then I tell people that the flat Earth idea is on par with the idea of a round Earth, well, I'm also just being critical of the idea of a round Earth. But, like being critical of evolution, it's really nothing but semantics. I'm just making up claims about evolution, saying I don't like it, and trying to sound scientific in the process. I'm sure, of course, there are some things that we do not know about evolution right now, but that doesn't mean that evolution is somehow wrong, or that we don't know that it occurred. As Eugenie Scott would say, scientists don't question about the whether evolution occurred, but the how evolution occurred. Of course, the main concern of this Icons of Evolution film were the outdated textbooks, quote-unquote. Yes, some of textbooks are outdated. I agree that they should be replaced with pertinent information. But to say that they're misleading kids with the examples, especially that they give, I do not see how they would mislead someone. But to make this claim is going a little far with these textbooks. Now, the video kept talking about a growing number of dissenting scientists questioning Darwin's theory. The Discovery Institute has 470 scientists so far. About, that's a rough approximation. I didn't go through and count every one of them. Now, the requirement for your signature is this. You need to have a PhD in mathematics, engineering, computer science, or any natural science at all. So, even if you do not have a biology degree, you can go ahead and sign the petition anyway and say, well, I'm critical of evolution. What's funny is that the National Center for Science Education has a counter-signature group called Project Steve, which has over 600 scientists, and in addition to having a PhD in mathematics, engineering, computer science, or any natural science, the scientists all have to be named Steve. So 600 scientists alone named Steve have signed this petition that says evolution is science and that intelligent design and creationism are not. So the National Center for Science Education kind of has an extra requirement, and yet they still have more scientists than the Discovery Institute has. But let's move in and see exactly how well Jonathan Wells and the intelligent design advocates debunk these notions, these icons of evolution that they call them. The first icon that we run into are Haeckel's embryos. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with these embryos, they're basically a set of drawings that were produced by a man, last name Haeckel, in the 19th century. And they're supposed to demonstrate how the similarities in the embryos could give evidence of a common ancestry. Now, Jonathan Wells says these were all faked. Now, this is a flat-out lie. Though Haeckel's embryos were exaggerated, they were not as close in similarity as he demonstrated they were in his drawings. The basic fact that embryology backs this notion of common descent is true. And his drawings are accurate to a degree. They're not totally accurate. Again, they were exaggerated. But the basic principle that they are very, very similar is correct. Now, one thing I'd like to point out that I'm glad the intelligent design guys did was they let Eugenie Scott, who is I believe, the director of the National Center for Science Education group, they let her kind of counterpoint with them and have a counterstatement. So they weren't just totally one-sided in this film. They were a lot at the time, but they were accurate in this. They were nice enough to let a counterpoint view come in. Next, after this icon of evolution, were Darwin's finches. I was interested in seeing how they would try to twist this in order to make Darwin's finches not an example of evolution. Now, they state that the textbooks apparently claim that you could extrapolate the beak changes in Darwin's finches to some kind of greater change. Again, they distinctly mention a micro versus macro evolution distinction, which really is not there. Wells claims that these finches aren't really separate species because they can interbreed. However, as a biologist, he should realize that that's only one definition of species, and that there's a notion known as morphological species, which is a very well-accepted definition of species that doesn't require two different species to be totally incapable of inbreeding. Morphology just applies to, basically, the body structure. So the differences in beak shape, size, diet, these are all factors that differ amongst these birds, and that allows us to conclude that they are separate species, that they are morphologically different species, not that they can't interbreed, but that these different factors allow us to conclude that they're different species. Now, Wells says we also can't extrapolate a common ancestor of these birds. However, in 2000, a publication which I was able to read through, which I will also post on the blog, it analyzed the molecular structures of each of these finches and showed that they all came from a single ancestral form. Now, again, this video, Icons of Evolution, came out in 2002, but the intelligent design advocates kind of neglected to mention this publication, that we know these Darwin's finches came from a common ancestor. Next, on the Icons of Evolution, we have fruit flies. Now, Wells claims that evolutionists, quote-unquote, use this as an example of speciation. What we had were two winged flies that allowed us to kind of produce four-winged flies, but the back two wings on these flies, as Wells points out, are really useless. They cannot be used for flying. So they're just kind of pointless. But various scientists, Massimo Pigliucci, for instance, doesn't say that fruit flies are an example of speciation, and that they shouldn't be used as them. What these fruit flies exemplify is that genes govern body structure. The National Center for Science Education states that textbooks rarely mention the fruit fly, and that when they do, it's the aforementioned example, that it's not to exemplify speciation, but that genes govern body structure. Wells has straw-man an evolutionary idea in order to try and destroy it, and we see this throughout the film. Next come bacterial resistance to antibiotics. Now, this is an easy case for evolution. This is a great example of natural selection. So I was interested again in seeing how Wells would try to spin this. Wells says the resistant strain of bacteria that survive the first wave of antibiotics are somehow weaker than the original strain, and there are some left of this original strain. Now, when they multiply, they somehow overpower the resistant strain, and so we're left with the weak strain again. This is kind of odd. I wonder, Wells doesn't actually say what makes these bacteria weaker, he just says they are, and he puts a little animation in there. But if the resistant population was destroyed, well then antibiotics would help, but then the bacteria would just kill itself off, and we'd be left right back at the beginning again. I don't see how we can have multiple resistant strains when the old, weaker bacteria, I mean the newer, weaker bacteria with the resistance, are all killed off in favor of the ones that have no resistance. It just doesn't make any sense. Wells then moves on to claim that homology, which is similarity in structure, is an icon of evolution. He says that different genes can control the same body structure, and so therefore, similar structure really means nothing. Wells expects the same genes to control the same body structure in every single creature. However, the overwhelming majority of biologists don't really agree with this view. Again, we see Wells is strawmanning evolution to fit his claim in order that he can destroy it. Scientists have known for a long time that genes can change function on the same structure. For instance, the PAX6 gene that controls the development of the eye in creatures with eyes has a different function in creatures without eyes. The same genes don't necessarily have to act on the same structure. Its similarity in structure does show constraint. Evolution can't just create totally new structures from scratch. The similar structure allows us to show that common ancestry occurred and that the retention of structure shows that tiny mutations over a long period of time can lead to new body structures, but basically the basic body structures are going to be retained. And that's what homology shows. So again, Wells tried to create an argument and destroy it, but he really wasn't attacking the claim that scientists make regarding homology and evolution. Lastly comes the Cambrian explosion claim. Or the claim they try to do is Darwin's Tree of Life. They try to overthrow this idea. The movie tries to claim that no one has any idea what happened during the Cambrian explosion, that there's no method, or that scientists are really, really arguing about it. I'd agree that scientists are arguing about what the cause of the Cambrian explosion was, but they do have mechanisms. For instance, climate change is one proposed mechanism of the Cambrian explosion. Lower temperatures were more hospitable to life. Again, creatures were just coming out of the water, and there are all these niches on the land to fill. And so, we would expect a large radiation of life to occur. Another idea is the Hox gene was activated during this time. The Hox gene controls basic body structures, and we'll get to that claim in a bit. But the Hox gene would create new body structures for these creatures, and mutations of the Hox gene will lead to new structures, though they're often non-functioning. But it could lead to new structures that would account for the wide variety of new body plans that we see in the Cambrian explosion. The movie makes an exaggeration about the Cambrian explosion. They say that all the major phyla are found in the Cambrian and have no Precambrian trace, or practically no Precambrian trace at least. Well, though there are many new body plans found, these often represent new species, and the phyla are subsequently created, and this is what taxonomists do. When they find a species, they are compelled to practically make a phyla, and so we see a lot of these phylas, but we don't know if they actually exist or that we're just creating them to fit these species. Also, from what I have read, all of the plant phyla appear after the Cambrian. Though we found genetic markers before the Cambrian, the plant phyla themselves don't actually appear until afterwards. Now the video, in trying to cover some of the counter-arguments by evolutionists, they say that soft body tissue idea, or the artifact hypothesis, is invalid. Now what this idea is that soft body tissue does not preserve as well as hard body stuff, and so we should expect to see less fossils in the Precambrian because soft tissue does not fossilize as well. But because they found some sponge embryos in a Chinese strata called Xinjiang, this is an area where they find the fossils, a lot of them from the Precambrian, they say they found these sponge embryos, and so that all the other soft body tissues should have preserved. Well, I find this claim kind of dubious. Why should all of the soft body tissue have preserved, or a large majority of it, I'm not saying all of it, why should a large majority of it have been preserved when the environment all over the world is not going to be the same? We're not going to have the same environment. It's not always going to be as favorable to fossilization as maybe Xinjiang was. And so to say that we should expect to see almost all of the soft body tissue preserved is a stretch, I would say. Next, in order to account for the Hox gene idea, the notion that the Hox gene could account for the Cambrian explosion, Jonathan Wells says the Hox gene is not activated until after the embryo stage, and so it cannot be responsible for the diversification of life at this time. Well, he's right, partly. It turns on right after the embryo stage, during the fetal stage, or the larval stage in the case of insects. But this is still going to change the creature in question. Fetuses don't stop developing in the fetal stage, and neither do larvae in the larval stage. The Hox gene can still account for diversification, and a mutation, as I said before, in the Hox gene can lead to many new, though often non-functioning, structures. Upon reaching the end of this film, or nearly to the end, the intelligent design advocates basically make a plea with the audience. They're trying to tell us that they're on the side of the U.S. Congress, because the U.S. Congress said that they wanted to teach all the scientific views when there are controversies. Well, the problem is this. Simply put, intelligent design is not science. So, it cannot be taught alongside evolution. It is not a scientific alternative to evolution because it is not scientific. So, this was Icons of Evolution. That was their claim. All their claims they've listed were basically refuted. And you can find refutations across them, about them scattered across the internet. You can find a good source on the National Center for Science Education website. I might put a link to that, or you can just Google it. And just Google for Icons of Evolution refutation, and you'll find a lot of information, especially on Talk Origins. So, those were the two DVDs I watched, and that was the refutation for each of them. Lastly, before I finish up, I'll go over a definition. This definition is adaptive radiation, and I came across it when I was looking up the Darwin Finches, and to see the counter-argument to what Jonathan Wells had said. Adaptive radiation is rapid speciation to fill a lot of ecological niches. For example, with Darwin's finches, we had a single finch, or a single species of finch, fly to the Galapagos Islands. Now, there are many different islands with many different climates, environments, etc. Many different diets were supported there. So, the birds on different islands would all occur, the speciation of these birds would occur rapidly. Beak sizes would change to fit the food. And note when I'm saying this, I do not mean that the beak sizes actually do change because they want to eat the food. That would be a teleological view. The birds that have the mutation that allows them to fit the food in their mouth and swallow it are going to survive, and the ones that don't have the right beak size will die off. So, that's what I mean when I say speciation. I don't mean that they actually try to fit their beak to the food. And this rapid speciation occurs in a lot of ecological niches. All these different islands have different niches that these birds can fill. For instance, there's a vampire finch that actually pecks and drinks the blood from a booby bird. And there's another bird, the woodpecker finch, that sticks a twig and tries to fish out insects in a tree. So there's all these different functions, all these different diets that these birds have. It's all due to adaptive radiation. Again, rapid speciation to fill a lot of ecological niches. Now, next week, we're most likely going to have an interview. I've been emailing again back and forth with one of my listeners who wants to be on the show, and I kind of invited him on the show. So we're going to be discussing extrapolation in science and how science can make claims about certain things that we don't have direct access to. For instance, we couldn't test that gravity worked in space back in the 16th century. We didn't know that the orbits would obey gravitational law. We had no reason to assume that. But we found that gravity works here on Earth, and we applied it to the heavens. And now that we're out in space, we know that this is actually true. Gravity applies elsewhere in space. And, of course, it's safe to assume that it occurs everywhere else in the universe. Again, these are basic assumptions of science, and we're going to see how that applies to intelligent design and creationism arguments, and why they say you can't, for instance, extrapolate microevolution to macroevolution, as they would put it. So that's most likely going to be the topic next week. Well, until then, everyone enjoy your week. Sorry for coming out with this podcast a little late, although I guess you're going to have to get used to it. And we will talk next week.